Welcome to the Floor Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Saturday, the 4th of October, and I'm recording at 1:30 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, I hope you were aware that I was going to be recording this Big Picture Outlook audio on Saturday rather than Friday. I had mentioned it in my two previous audios on Wednesday and on Thursday. And I also mentioned it in my comment of the day as well, right at the end of it, that I would be recording on Saturday. Okay, let's start by first just having a quick review of what happened during the week, and I'll focus on Wall Street here, because it's going to certainly be the big influence overall. And the action was very choppy, as you know. Started the week on a soft tone, extending the decline that we had seen on the previous week, and so we saw a little over 2 weeks to the downside, and that had caused some failed upward breaks for leading indices off new highs, and just took out some very initial minor support levels, but all occurring within the overall upward trends for the and above the 200-day moving averages for the leading indices. The Russell 2000, as you know, which I've been referring to as the canary in the coal mine, was considerably weaker overall. It did bounce on Thursday quite well, better than the broader indices, and it had a modest gain on Friday, so it's a little bit above the 1100 level, but not out of the danger zone by a long shot. And nor are the major indices, because effectively what they almost regained was the weakness the additional weakness that we saw last Wednesday, which I mentioned a moment ago, was a bigger downward move. So looking at those various indices, you know, we're about over 30%, 40% off the of the decline has been retraced off the highs that we had seen over 2 weeks ago. Okay. So what's all this mean, and where do we actually go from here? Well, there's an old saying, quite a good one, that it ain't over until it's over. And if you look at the S&P 500 index, which is certainly a very, very important one, it's positioned at a delicate level. On the upper side, you have that 2,000 big, 2,000 psychological target roundophobia levels. Those can always interrupt trends for a while. And the high was just a little over the 2020 level. And on the lower side, we have the last in the long sequence of higher reaction lows at just above 1900. And we got close to that on Thursday, but didn't quite take out the previous reaction low near that 1900. We did not quite reach that level. here we have an S&P now today at following Friday's close at 1967. Now, this range is going to be quite emotive when we get a breakout to the upward side or the downward side, and a break to the upward side with a close above that 2020 level, if maintained for more than a day or two, that would be regarded by most people as reconfirmation of the overall upward trend, and it would still look okay on the charts overall. A break of the 1900 level, on the other hand, would clearly look different. It would break that long progression of higher reaction lows that we have seen throughout this year and extending back into last year, and that would certainly be a sign of technical deterioration. Now, what about the background to all this? Well, everybody knows that the quantitative easing ends this month in the United States. There have been concerns that we were going to see short-term interest rates move higher. My guess is, and some people have been calling that for quite some time, as you're probably well aware, my guess is that we aren't going to see the Fed do anything like increase short-term interest rates this year. Their decision, as the Fed itself has said, and sensibly, will be based on economic data. But one of the bits of economic data that the Fed will certainly be paying a lot of attention to is the current strength of the U.S. dollar, which is seeing a big move to the upside, and it actually surged on Friday. Looks overextended to me on the upside, but the point is, it's still in quite a clear overall upward trend. Now, as I say, the Fed will be watching that because the temptation to raise interest rates, short-term interest rates, will certainly be reduced by the strength of the U.S. dollar, which is doing part of their job for them if there's any concern about overheating or inflationary concerns. And my guess still is that we are a long way off, not only in terms of not seeing a short-term interest rate hike in the U.S. this year, but probably we won't see that until well into the 2015 period. Okay, what are the other factors here that I'm concerned about? And I'll end with the most important one here overall. But people are concerned about geopolitical factors from the Middle East because they see this long extension to the struggle there to try to contain or as Barack Obama says, to eliminate ISIL. Real danger there, which has not occurred in terms of global markets. It's been a real tragedy for lots of people in the region, obviously, but the real tragedy in terms of markets would be spikes in the price of oil, and far from that occurring, we're seeing crude oil prices continue to move down as they did again on Friday. And you've got the WTI price at $89.74. And we have the Brent, which is a more important price, just a little above 90. So this has been a major retracement, bad for oil producers for the most part, good for economies around the world. And that has to be factored in. Some people are a little bit concerned about the deflationary consequences of that, and I would say that's premature. There are deflationary factors in markets that we need to pay attention to, not least regarding the European zone, especially the EU portion of the of Europe. But more on that in a moment. The Chinese situation is a concern, and I think many of us who are international investors, let alone have investments in China and Hong Kong, are anxious to see what happens here on Monday, because basically over the 3 weeks that this these demonstrations have occurred, and we certainly understand why China is taking a tough line on the political freedoms that the Hong Kong Chinese would actually like. But a lot of those Hong Kong Chinese, if you read the press and hear today, are becoming more concerned about the disruption of their businesses and the cost and in terms of corporate profits, but it's the man on the street just as much the big Chinese corporations, taxi drivers, for instance, all been impacted by this. So that's a concern. The Russian situation is a concern. People keep mentioning Ebola. I think that's the least of the geopolitical concerns, and hopefully it stays that way. But there are a number of geopolitical events that have had investors more nervous than possible at a time when markets and particularly not least Wall Street have been on a high, very much on a high. The one that worries me the most is leverage. And I've mentioned this on a number of occasions, including suggesting to investors that they reduce their own leverage. But as much as you re might reduce your sensibly reduce your own leverage, the hedge funds, and there are of course hedge fund in investors and managers listening to this audio as well among the collective of subscribers, have a lot of leverage. There are also the high-frequency trading participants who helped to create such a persistent move to the upside overall. Now, I'm hoping to get more data on leverage over the course of next week. It's not always that easy to get what's relevant, but certainly it's an obvious point that the hedge funds are quite over-leveraged. That leverage always increases when you get a strong, persistent move to the upside, and also you get many individual traders who also increase their leverage very, very substantially. And the trouble is that that can turn what would be in other conditions when leverage is much lower, what might be a normal, healthy correction of 10% or so, it can greatly exaggerate it as that leverage is actually unwound. So I think that's really quite a high risk. Watch out if we see the Russell 2000, if we see that rally peter out here just a little above 1100 and then start to head down again. But more importantly, now watch the S&P 500. If that pushes above the 2020 level, as I mentioned, then people will relax again for a while longer. And on the other hand, though, if it moves down below that 1900 level, that would be moving down a little bit below the 200-day moving average, and it would also be taking out the last reaction low that you can see on the daily and the weekly charts there. So, in other words, it would be breaking the progression of higher reaction lows. If we are near a somewhat important medium-term high in here, then it would not be surprising to see whipsaws in either direction. So it's not going to be easy to assess this overall because very often if you get anything other than spike highs, you get choppy action, which breaks support levels and breaks resistance levels. And it's whipsaw activity, and that also following a big move to the upside, as we have certainly seen not only late last year, but in the well, not only in the at least the fourth quarter of last year, but all of this year to date, and whipsaw ranging sideways activity. Would certainly break the trend consistency characteristics and increasingly increase investor concerns overall. So it's a risky period. We could easily see that 10% plus correction, as I've been mentioning for a long time, but the leverage is the factor that could make it somewhat bigger. What is somewhat bigger? Well, I think what I would describe as a cyclical bear phase, which is something a little over 20%, is one of the risks. Now, we also know that the December, the beg your pardon, the October period, just as with September, can be a more choppy period for markets. If we haven't broken down towards the end of October, and if the trends are still intact, then I think sentiment would improve here once again. But the obvious point is be careful in terms of your leverage that you actually have, and reduce it if you possibly can. If you have a portfolio which consists largely of autonomies, which are providing reasonable yields, you can ride out anything to the downside. I think it would make you nervous. You certainly wouldn't want to be selling those shares against a background of obvious weakness. So the point is, if you're going to lighten up, do so early, not late, in an overall move. And the most important point that I'm trying to make is that those autonomies, which do not have high valuations, which have conservative valuations relative to the S&P overall, and it's preferably below 15 on price earnings ratios, and decent yields of 3, 4, 5%, those shares would certainly hold up better, and I think would also continue to do well in the subsequent recovery that would occur overall. Okay, what about other factors here that are important? Well, currency, I mentioned the US dollar's real strength that we have seen here, and that reflects not only people buying dollars generally, but more money pushing into the US stock market overall. On the weakness side of the currency markets, the euro is really the biggest factor. That's down to just above the 1.25 level against the US dollar following Friday, when the euro fell quite sharply. Europe needs this. Mario Draghi has wanted this. Remember, it wasn't all that long ago when it was up at 140, which certainly made him unhappy, and it was only up there because the euro is really the world's second largest reserve currency. But the European region is still in trouble, not least from the overall economic policies that it has long had, but also because of the cost of the sanctions that we see in the standoff with Russia, which is certainly not a resolved issue. And Mario Draghi has done well, is doing everything in his, let's put it this way, not entirely freehand position in terms of his powers. I mean, he'd like to be doing quantitative easing, and Germany's blocking that, as you know. But that's the reality. That's created this weak economic zone, and the euro will provide some cushion for that. And I must say, it's awfully good for German exporters, isn't it? And they're not experiencing too much in the way of increasing prices, and other big exporters within the European region. Sterling has inevitably been affected by that somewhat. Remember when sterling was at the 170 level not all that long ago? And certainly the protests were being heard from British exporters. Well, as of Friday, sterling closed under the 160 level. It's much stronger than the euro, but it's down off that high level, and that will ease the pressures on British exporters, although their markets to continental Europe, which are hugely important, obviously remain weak. Exports to the U.S. are very likely to be increasing from both Europe and the U.K. Elsewhere, we haven't had a lot of volatility in currencies. The Asian currencies have been weaker against the U.S. dollar, particularly the Japanese yen, which is now at 109.76. I expect the yen to weaken further over the next few months, and that would help to underpin the sort of faltering, I should say, economic recovery that we are seeing in Japan. And the interesting one is the Chinese renminbi. We hear a lot of talk about China slowing down and no longer 7.5% GDP growth, and some people are saying it's going to be more like 5 or even slightly below that, which doesn't sound that good, but it sounds relative to what China's done in the past, but it sounds awfully good in terms of what many other countries are actually experiencing in terms of their GDP growth. And it also, to put it in global perspective, it's regarded as somewhat bearish, not least in terms of commodity prices, although that has a lot more to do with the shift away from all the metal bashing that China had previously done towards trying to move the economy up into a higher consumer, more technology-oriented type of environment. But remember, if it's 5 or 4.5% GDP growth out of China, that's one heck of a lot better for the whole global economy than, say, a 15% growth if we'd had it back 20 years ago. So just to keep things in perspective, because the Chinese economy is so much bigger and stronger overall. And yes, of course, it has plenty of problems that extend beyond beyond Hong Kong, but it also has among the best valuations overall. Looking at the Asian economies that I like the most, I'll mention them very quickly because you're well aware of them, but among the Asia-Pacific region, well, India, if India gets a correction, that's another buying opportunity. Vietnam, the biggest problem for Vietnam really is the big red fist of China. That can be unsettling, as we've also seen in Hong Kong. But that creates buying opportunities when you get reactions for that reason. Japan, among the developed economies. So I mentioned India, developing and very hugely important developing economy. And I think people are still mostly underestimating Narendra Modi. I think that would be a shame if investors continue to do that, because this is one of the brightest politicians in terms of economic policy that is on the world stage today. He's also a very charismatic figure, as you're seeing, and that will certainly help. And he's concentrating in the right areas of infrastructure and getting more businesses, global businesses, to invest in India. And that's on top of the very strong pharmaceutical and IT sectors that India already has. So I think it's an outstanding story. And if India gets a correction in here, again, I would say that would be a buying opportunity. Same for Vietnam, although Vietnam is not the story that India is. And Japan. I give it the benefit of the doubt here so far, although a lot of people will take a long time convincing, which is inevitable when you saw over two decades of deterioration in that Japanese economy. And I think Europe, I'd be cautious just because the going forward, but the autonomies, the big multinational companies in Europe that aren't dependent entirely on what actually happens in Europe, those are the ones to be to remain interested in. Ditto the U.S. as I've already mentioned. Okay, the commodity markets. That's well. Let me take the bond markets here first. Incredibly low yields, as you saw. I think bond markets are the great bubble overall. How can that be? I ask the rhetorical question. When central banks are among the biggest buyers in some of these Western bond markets, for instance, and the fact is that they too are fueling have been fueling a bubble in bonds. I mean, it's just a con let's step back and just put it on a common sense basis. Here, you've got some of the lowest yields that we've seen recently in these government bonds across Europe and the USA, UK. Some of the lowest yields that you've seen in your lifetime, unless you're even older than I am, and you go back and you but you've got to go a long way back to find similar lows. So, from a common sense standpoint, when you say what actually preceded those actual lows, well, it was you've got to go back a long way to see the highest yields, and over we've got over 30 years of what has been a bull market that I'm happy to describe, or I'm not happy is the wrong word, but that I'm not I'm not hesitant to describe as a bubble. That's the right terminology to use. And you just know that out there, the risks are going to increase for people who are holding those positions. If you are in those bond markets, keep it very short term. That's the obvious point. And I'd stay away from the funds, the bond funds. Okay, commodities. Here, the commodity markets have been weaker than I was expecting this year, and there are good reasons for that. In some instances, take the agricultural commodities overall; those downward trends, for the most part, particularly for staple grains, such as, well, staple grains, including rice, corn, soybeans, wheat, that's very favorable for the poorer regions of the global economy. It's good generally overall. It's the blessings of good weather. For the most part, there have been exceptions. We know about the Brazilian coffee problems, and that has kept coffee prices considerably higher than the staple grains that I just mentioned. And we also know what a tough time California has had in terms of its weather. But worldwide, it has been generally a superb year 2014, and that breaks the biblical 7 years of difficult crop conditions. Hopefully, we get more of that because the world can use it. In terms of the industrial commodities, well, that reflects production, and it also reflects slow global GDP growth. Which is in line with the long, lengthy recoveries that are required following credit crisis recessions. My guess is that we see another 3 to maximum 5 years of what are less than ideal growth conditions, to put it that way. And where we see probably a better way to phrase it is to say 3 to 5 years in which we do not have a fully synchronized global economy in terms of GDP growth. When we do head towards that global synchronized global economy in terms of GDP growth, that will be good for stock markets initially, and then be followed by a cyclical bear market, because it will also push interest rates up quite sharply. But that's well down the road. And so I think in terms of a few years of somewhat choppy conditions. That's by no means a disaster. The downside is that you get some, as I've mentioned already, or at least one cyclical bear market of 20% plus, to repeat that number. I am really quite hopeful that we don't see anything like the 20%. I beg your pardon. I'm very hopeful that we don't get anything like the 2000 bear trend or the 2008 bear trend, which was such a setback for the global economy. But back to these commodities here overall. The taking these industrial commodities, the weaker oil prices are a very positive factor for all but some of the producers, and Russia's among the worst hit of those oil producers. I'd stay away from that Russian stock market while Putin is in charge. And by the media, when he is no longer in charge, assuming that the next successor isn't coming from a similar KGB background. But I'm good to diversify. I'm sorry, I'm digressing away from commodities again. Industrial metals and crude oil, which I have covered. One of my big long-term forecasts for crude oil is that it would be cheaper in real terms as we go ahead. And I think the factors are bringing that about, if anything, a little bit sooner than I was actually hoping. But that's good for the global economy, good for long-term GDP growth in this big picture outlook overall. Metal prices, partly reflecting the change in the Chinese economy and slow global that I mentioned earlier, and also global GDP growth that we are seeing. But also there's a technology factor in here as well. Technology is affecting everything, which you will have certainly noticed over the last decade, and the technological changes are actually accelerating. That is also good for global GDP growth. It's not always good for job creation, but in time, additional jobs will be also created. But that technological lead in terms of the metal prices means that the big well-financed miners, I'm thinking of the Rio Tintos and the BHP Billitons, two of which I hold in my portfolio, shares have been underperforming because the price of iron ore is moving down, but they can produce so much more efficiently than many of the smaller, less global regional producers. While global GDP growth is slow, that will be an obvious headwind for metal prices to the upside. That's no bad thing for the global economies. It may well slow the recovery, as it already has, in terms of mining shares overall. But the point I'm trying to make here is that if you're interested in that lagging sector and the valuations are attractive, a lot of people don't want to have anything to do with it. Historically, that's a good sign. Most of the people are out of the market, except for the really long-term investors. But where you have decent yields in the miners and big well-financed companies that can ride out this very difficult period, they will also be increasing their market share and will emerge from this environment in a strong position when the global economy is picking up, and I'm put that out about 3 to 5 years down the road. But those miners will ultimately do well. The danger areas are in small mining companies where you've got to get lucky. In other words, they have to discover a major new resource or get taken over. But if they get taken over because they're in depressed conditions, shareholders don't do very well out of that environment. Well, okay, I don't want to run on too long. I probably already have. But I just wish you a most enjoyable remainder to your weekend and all the very best from me. Bye.